Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host this evening. Precision medicine is an emerging field in healthcare, and it's being utilized to tailor treatment for cancer patients. Genomic sequencing, which looks specifically at the DNA, specifically is looking for the makeup of tumors, that is, the genes, and how this relatively new and leading targeted instrument, I guess you would call it, is being used to alter treatment and to open up new treatment possibilities for some patients is going to be a focus of our conversation today. So we're going to be talking about that, and we have a number of guests this evening who are on the cutting edge of treatment for cancer and specifically genetic sequencing. We're also going to talk about pancreatic cancer and lung cancer, as it is both Pancreatic Cancer Month and Lung Cancer Awareness Month. And joining me this evening in the studio, we have Dr. Mindy Cavanaugh, Assistant Clinical Professor of Internal Medicine and Medical Oncology at LSU Health in Shreveport and at the Feisweiler Cancer Center. Dr. Cavanaugh has been utilizing genomic sequencing to provide targeted treatments to her patients. We'll also be joined by Dr. Ellen Friday, who's Assistant Professor, Research Science Director, also at Feisweiler Cancer Center, and specifically works in the Precision Medicine Genomic Lab and is Technical Director of the Feisweiler Cancer Center Tissue and Serum Repository. We'll find out a little bit more exactly what that is. And we also have Dr. Michael Dersey, who is a radiation oncologist at Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Welcome. Appreciate you having you here this evening.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to remind our listeners that Health Matters is a live show, and we invite you to join our discussion. We will take your questions and comments at 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Okay, well, this is a big topic, genes and cancer. You know, when I was in medical school learning about cancer, these cancer genes were just first being discovered, and that was a little while ago. But anyway, things have changed a lot, and it's really revolutionized the treatment of cancer. So I guess we're going to talk a lot about genes and DNA and DNA sequencing, but I think there are some terms we need to be familiar with. So just to get started, let's move with the geneticist, Dr. Friday. Can you please tell our listeners exactly what are genes and what are DNA and what are mutations, and what does that have to do with cancer?
Well, basically, the DNA is just the building blocks that tell our cells what to make. I like to use the analogy of my genome is like a cookbook. It's everything I could potentially make. What the body needs is what the end product. It's my cupcake because I feel like cupcakes today. So the genes are my cookbook. Everything that I need, everything that I have to make. My body is my kitchen. It has all my equipment. It has all my supplies. And then the final product, the proteins, are what we need to carry on our bodily processes.
Okay, so the cookbook. I guess the cookbook is the DNA.
The DNA.
Okay. And then I guess the words are the genes.
Words are the genes.
Okay. And then the letters, what would the letters be in those words? Let me ask you this. So those words, if you change some of the letters, does it ever change the word?
It absolutely does. It's if you think about it, and I use this cooking analogy when I talk to medical students. If you think about it, if a mutation, I'm making my cupcakes and I'm supposed to put in a cup of sugar, but I have a mistake. It says a cup of salt. Mm-hmm. You know, that radically changes my final product.
Right.
We also have, you can have another form of mutation where your cookbook company was a shoddy company. And so halfway through the cupcake recipe, you get the ingredients for marinara. Mm-hmm. And so when you put those two together, your final product is going to be changed.
Okay. So basically, use the word mutation. Mm-hmm. So would a mutation be where, let's say, some letters were changed and you ended up with a different word, and then your ingredients got changed around and you'd end up with a mess of something that you didn't want?
A mess of something that you didn't want, absolutely.
And that's cancer?
That's absolutely cancer.
Okay. So what distinguishes cancer from, let's say, non-cancer or an otherwise healthy cell?
So healthy cells, they are able to follow the recipe. We're going to continue with that analogy and make cupcakes or make pancakes or make whatever you want. With cancer cells, what happens is that the sort of the end of the recipe doesn't tell you to stop. So you just continue to make the same thing over and over and over again. So now, instead of having 5 cupcakes that you needed and then moving on to do something else, now you have 400 cupcakes.
So for those listeners who remember this, what I Love Lucy episode, Dr. Kavanaugh, you may not remember this, but I remember an episode where Lucy and what was her friend?
Ethel.
Thank you, Ethel. They were working like in some sort of a cupcake or donut factory or something like that. And it was coming off the conveyor belt and it wouldn't stop and things like that. And they were getting all messed up. So I guess that's kind of the analogy. Since we were talking about cupcakes,
correct,
I guess we can think of it in terms of that. So it's uncontrolled.
Yes. Normally your body stops making a cell. You know, it needs however many cells, it stops making them. Well, in cancer, something happens that process doesn't get stopped. And so the cells continue to be produced, and they're not normal cells. So they don't follow the rules and do the right things like normal cells do.
And I guess they come together and they form a tumor.
That's right.
And then sometimes they spread.
That's right. And so as they grow, like you said, you get a tumor. Well, eventually those cells kind of get greedy and they don't have the blood supply they need or the nutrients they need to continue on growing. And so they break off and try to go to new places to be able to find somewhere to grow or nutrients, things like that.
So why do some people get cancer and other people not get cancer?
So there's a few different ways that it can be. Traditionally, cancer is of the aging population. Just unfortunately, as our body is constantly making mistakes, just like we do as humans, except for, you know, your body has a way to repair those and get rid of those mistakes before they make their cupcakes or before the body does what it needs to do. The problem is, as we get older, our body's not as good at repairing those mistakes. And so as you accumulate more of these mistakes that aren't repaired, that's when you have a higher chance of having what we call a sporadic or a random cancer, meaning it's just unlucky chance. And then there's another way also, you can pass down genes that can produce cancer through families. And that's a lot of times when we see cancer at a younger age or cancer that accumulates within a family. And, you know, now we're starting to see cancer at a younger age that we don't think is necessarily due to, due to family or due to the genes that your family has passed down to you, but maybe from diet or environment or other things that cause these mutations or these errors in the DNA, and your body doesn't have a way to fix those.
I see. And so this genetic sequencing that we're talking about this evening, how does that fit into this description of genes and cancer?
Well, we've looked at the human genome. So we've looked at our genes, and those tell us if someone has a predisposition to cancer. So like everyone's heard about BRCA mutations in breast cancer and things. That is something that is in all of your cells. That's in your genes that have been passed down from your parents. Now, what we actually look at is the DNA of the tumor. So why are these cells continuing to grow, inappropriately? Why are these doing something they're not supposed to versus the rest of the normal tissue that's not it's not changing, because, you know, not everything comes from the genes that you get from your parents. Sometimes it's just one or two cells that have these mutations, and that's how it starts. And then those continue to, like I said, grow and become cancer from that.
So when you look at the DNA inside the tumor itself, in some ways, if I understand, in some ways it's the same as the genes in the rest of the body and the genes that you get from your parents. But then in some cases you may have mutations that are just brand new that are being caused by things in the environment, like, let's say, smoking.
Correct.
Okay. And so now, since some of these cancers do run in families but are also environmentally influenced, is it necessarily one or the other, or can you have genes passed down from your parents that put you at a predisposition that then the environmental thing can trigger a cancer?
Absolutely. And that is more how most even of the genetic cancers work. It's just because you have the gene that gets passed down doesn't 100% mean you are absolutely going to get that cancer. You know, we know for different genes, there's a much higher risk. It may mean that you have a 60% risk of getting breast cancer in your lifetime instead of a 20% risk. Or, you know, I mean, we know there's different risks depending on what gene it is. And so most cases, it is not just because of the genetic mutation you get. There is a cancer syndrome called Li-Fermini that is a mutation in a very important gene, and that is one that we know that some sort of cancer is, you know, the patient will get some sort of cancer at a young age, usually maybe a little bit older age, but it's one that we know will get cancer at some point, isn't necessarily environmentally influenced.
Okay, so now for our listeners, they're probably wondering, okay, so is there tests that I can go get to tell me whether I'm going to get a cancer or predict whether I'm going to get a cancer, or for that matter, if I have cancer? Is that the kind of testing you're talking about, or is that different?
So it's a little bit different. And let me touch on that really quickly because that's important. If you are worried about those questions, the best thing to do is to talk to even your family practitioner or your internist about other people in your family. So start by talking to your family about maybe illnesses that run in your family or cancers, things like that. Then go talk to a doctor and see if you would be someone that should get a genetic testing to see if you have a higher likelihood of cancer. Because, you know, sometimes there's a lot of commercial tests that you can order on Amazon and different places and get, but it's hard to know what to do with that information unless you have talked to a doctor about it or, you know, found out your risk. And that's usually based on the other people in your family and different things like that that your primary doctor would assist you with.
So this is different than 23andMe?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. How is it different, Dr. Friday?
23andMe is a test that's basically, it's looking at what's going on pretty much in every cell in your body. So that's just giving you sort of an overall broad view. What we're doing is we're honing in specifically on what's causing your disease process. So what's different about your cancer from what's going on in the rest of your body.
Okay, so this is specifically looking at the tumor, not looking at the person.
Yes.
Okay. And so is this relatively new?
It is. It's been around in the research world for a long time, trying to figure out how to use the information that we're getting. It's been commercially available from a few different places for probably six years. We've been doing it for a year now here locally. And the benefit of doing it here locally, well, there's many benefits. For me, as a person who treats patients, the benefit for me is that we can provide this for patients, all of our patients. It's not just saying, well, what insurance do you have to decide if you can get this test? Where before, when we had to use one of the tests that was run in somewhere in the Northeast, it was only patients with certain insurances. And it took 2-3 weeks, and we rarely got anything that was clinically useful. So when Dr. Friday and Dr. Shadwell and Dr. Mills got together and were designing this and wanting to bring this into Louisiana, one thing that they really looked at was providing it to every single patient, no matter what the insurance coverage is, and also making it so that it is useful information for the patient to benefit from it.
That's great, because I imagine it would be very expensive. So if there are commercial tests available that, let's say, are covered by insurance, or the test available at LSU, which sounds like it's available to everybody, are there specific differences between these tests in terms of the genes that are tested or the number of genes that are tested, Dr. Friday?
It can vary widely. Some of the commercial tests can be as few as 10 genes. The panel we run is 435. There are a few that are a little bit bigger. But I would say the bigger panel is not always better, because I can give Mindy a list of 100 genes, but if only 5 of them are going to affect how she's going to treat her patient or how she's going to stage her patient, then, you know, the other 95 may not have any benefit at the time. Another difference in the differences in the panels are in genes, there are certain regions, and we call them hotspots, where the genes tend to be mutated, that error occurs more frequently. So some of the commercial panels will only test that small area. So if you are one of the 80% whose DNA change is there, great, you are covered. But if you're that small percentage that the change in that gene falls outside of that area, it's missed by that test.
I see. So how is this used clinically, Dr. Cavanaugh?
So, and to make this clear, because I get this question from a lot of patients, this is used for patients whose cancer cannot be cured. So the cancer has moved somewhere else, or the cancer has come back in a different location. That is very different from someone who the cancer is only localized in one area and the goal is to get rid of it completely or to cure it.
So how does a doctor determine whether that cancer can be cured or not?
There's different methods depending on what type of cancer it is, but the biggest thing is that say you have colon cancer, if it's now spread from your colon to your liver or to your lungs or to other places in the body, it's what we call metastatic, or generally we consider it stage 4 cancer.
Okay. And are you testing all of your patients with this technique?
So currently, the cancers that are more rare and don't have good treatments, sort of pancreatic cancer, esophageal cancer, things like that, I do the cancerplex testing immediately. Also because with pancreatic cancer and some of the other cancers that are harder to biopsy or to get a piece of the cancer to look at to determine exactly what type of cancer it is, when it's harder to biopsy, we don't have as much tissue to use to look at different mutations. And with this test, you can use a very small amount of tissue to get me all of this information. That way the patient doesn't have to undergo multiple biopsies, multiple tests, multiple procedures to get the information.
So you haven't. So it sounds like this information helps to direct care.
It does. And then, so as far as cancers that are more common, colon cancer, breast cancer, things that we have treatments that are what we call kind of first line, or that we're going to use up front, we generally start some sort of treatment and then order this test kind of at the same time. That way, as we're planning for the future, because remember, we're talking about cancers that we can't cure. Our goal is to keep them under control. Our goal is to keep them from spreading as long as we can. The chemotherapies, as I kind of say, get smarter than our treatments. And so we always want to make sure we know what we can use next. And that's really what with this test helps me.
So why wouldn't you use this test in the beginning or earlier stages of cancer?
So right now, the way we do things is based on research. And there's, research showing that there's certain medications that work up front very well for certain diseases. Certain cancers, we don't have medications that work as well, so we may use it sooner. But if we have a proven therapy that has been tested in very good trials, we still use that first. And okay. then as that doesn't, you know, that doesn't work or the cancer gets smarter, yeah. The chemos or the treatments tend to not work as well.
I see. So you mentioned chemo. So let's talk a little bit about what exactly is chemo? Are there different types of chemo and how does chemotherapy work?
So there's definitely multiple different types. So the traditional what people think of as chemo that you kind of see in the movies, we now somewhat call cytotoxic chemotherapy, which would mean, you know, cyto meaning cell and toxic meaning it's bad for your cells. And so it's not targeted. It's very widespread. That's why you think of people feeling bad and throwing up and losing their hair. While we can control those things with medicines, you know, traditional chemotherapies are what we call cytotoxic chemos. That's what you're thinking of.
So it's not specific necessarily to the tumor. It treats the healthy tissues as well.
Correct.
But how does it work down on the genes? How does it work at the cellular level on to be so toxic?
So there's different ways, but a lot of them interrupt either kind of the cell cycle as the cell divides, or, you know, and they work specifically on the DNA replication like we talked about.
So it tears pages out of the cookbook.
Yes, and kind of doesn't allow that stop, doesn't say quit making the muffins. It messes with the DNA replication. It can change the way that the tumor cells, some of the enzymes they use. There's a lot of different ways that it works at the actual DNA level to try to interrupt the cancer from continuing to divide over and over and over again.
Okay, and there's other types of chemotherapy that maybe are not cytotoxic?
There is. So there's another kind of group, what we call of more targeted therapies, that those are very wide and very, and a lot of different ones. But basically what those are is more targeted to either some sort of marker on the cell or a pathway within the body that functions to, that's maybe not working right. Or we know that if that pathway's turned on, it may cause cancer when we don't want it to be turned on. And then the biggest group really that I think now probably people know the most about is what we call immunotherapy. And this is very important because immunotherapy is almost the opposite of those cytotoxic therapies. With cytotoxic therapies, we think of them kind of pushing the immune system down and the immune system not working. With the newest kind of line of treatment, immunotherapy, the whole goal is to make it so that the immune system realizes that this cancer is bad. Cancer, one of the ways cancer hides is it makes your body think it's supposed to be there. And so your normal immune system that fights off infections, things like that, because they're bad, doesn't fight the cancer off because it hides and it says, I'm supposed to be here, leave me alone. With these immunotherapies, we can kind of turn that immune system back on. And now the immune system says, oh, hey, this cancer is bad. We need to get rid of it. So that's kind of the newest ways to treat patients. And the good thing about this immunotherapy is it doesn't go in and attack all of the normal cells that are dividing. So patients don't get as sick. Are there side effects? There are side effects, but they are much less. And the infusion times are much shorter. And we seem to be having a lot of very good results with these therapies.
Okay, and that's used a little later on in treatment as well.
It is. It's starting to become earlier in some types of cancer. But in general, right now, it's still used more second line, you know, meaning not the first course of chemo, but maybe the second or third.
Okay, very good. Dr. Dursey, okay, so bring you into the discussion. We heard a bit about how chemotherapy and targeted therapy works and kills cancer cells. Radiation, I know, is commonly used to treat cancer cells as well. Does that work differently than chemotherapy?
Mechanistically, it works pretty differently just because of how the toxicity is delivered. So chemotherapy can go in and mess with the DNA or the dividing cell, but the radiation, it is energy coming from a machine and going into the cell where it puts a nick or hole in the DNA. That in and of itself will not hurt a cell. But when it tries to divide without that information available, it will then die. So radiation is made to be more selective geometrically, just by aiming at the spot that you want. The cells in the area can all be damaged. The tumor cells tend to die more because, given the damage, they don't repair it very well, whereas the normal cells do repair it pretty well. And so as you go on with the treatment, the tumor cells begin to die more and more. The normal cells are more or less putting it back together and getting back into shape.
So with the chemotherapy or the other types of therapies Dr. Kavanaugh was talking about, she mentioned infusion, which is an injection. I know there's chemo pills, various sorts that you can take. Now, with the radiation, you said it's delivered by a machine and it's aimed or targeted. Are there other ways of giving radiation?
So, yeah, tons of ways to give radiation. And you could break it down into external, internal, or brachytherapy, or systemic even. So external is probably the most common. If you happen to know somebody who had radiation, more than likely he or she had external beam, meaning the person was laying on a table and a machine about, you know, a meter away, a yard away, was aiming a beam at that particular area, the prostate, the breast, the whatever. And the machine is on for 30 or 40 seconds and the whole thing doesn't take very long. And we have different machines that do that. Linear accelerators make x-rays or electrons. There are protons, which are heavy particles, relatively few of those centers in the country, but definitely applicable for certain disease sites. Then there's the internal treatments or brachytherapy, which just is a word that means treatment at a short distance. And to do brachytherapy, which is a great way to treat it, it's a little more difficult because you have to get a radioactive source close to the tumor or in the tumor. And so you might be able to do that by putting a source down through a tube into the lung. You might be able to do it by putting it through the vagina up into the uterus. You might be able to do it by going through the artery and depositing little beads into the liver. That's something called Y90. And then the final kind of radiation is systemic, and that's just something that's injected into the bloodstream, and it can go all over the place. And there's a few of those, primarily for treating bones. So Xofigo is one. That's the name of it. It's radium, and it goes to the bone, and it treats bone lesions, primarily for prostate cancer. Samarium is another one that is similar.
So are these so we have liquid chemotherapy. Now, is the liquid radiation, is it generalized or is that targeted as well? Because I know people get radioactive iodine and that's very specific for the thyroid. Are these liquid radiation solutions, are they specific or do they affect the whole body?
The liquid radiation solutions tend to be more selective. That is to say, for example, the Xofigo is going to pretty much isolate into the bone and not go to the lungs or liver or anything like that. Really cool one called lutetium dotatate, but it's just a complicated word. But there's some tumors called neuroendocrine tumors, which are less common tumors of the pancreas or the gut. But you can tag a piece of radiation onto this marker, and it seeks out and just binds only to those tumors. So you're injecting it into the bloodstream, but nevertheless, it's only settling out where the tumors are. And that could be in the liver or in the gut or wherever they happen to be. So those are kind of smart bullets.
Wow. So it sounds like biotechnology and engineering is really advancing cancer treatment, whether it be with radiation or with systemic therapies. I want to remind our listeners that our guests are available for your questions. You can call in at 1-800-552-8502. So, Dr. Dursey, Dr. Kavanaugh was saying that sometimes she uses the gene sequencing, the DNA sequencing, to determine what kind of treatment her patients get. Does DNA sequencing have a role to play when selecting radiation?
For the most part, I'd say we don't really utilize a lot of DNA sequencing in radiation. There are DNA syndromes, people who have DNA, they can't repair their DNA. And those people are susceptible to getting tumors, but radiation is a really not good idea for treating them, because the damage that you instill, they can't repair that either.
Yeah.
That fortunately is not very many people.
What about with prostate cancer? I understand there's a test where you can look at the genes in the prostate cancer and kind of get a sense on how aggressive to treat or maybe not treat at all.
Right.
What about that?
So especially prostate cancer is a relatively slow growing cancer, often can sit around for years doing nothing in particular. And there are a couple tests for that. And similar also for breast cancer to some degree, where you're looking at a panel of genes. You may absolutely have no idea why the genes matter, but you know if you see certain ones of them, it's going to make that particular tumor more aggressive. So in the prostate setting, if you have what seems to be an early tumor, you might check it and say, oh, well, yeah, it really is kind of indolent, not likely to do much. Or you could say, unfortunately, despite the fact that it looks pretty good on a microscope, your genetics say it might act a little more harshly. And so you could proceed with that. Again, as we go forward with this, and this will be the part that's really interesting, it'll be figuring out, geez, you know, because you have gene G, H, and I, it's bad because this particular product is occurring, and that will help develop even more treatment modalities. But still, trying to figure out that having those genes means you have a more aggressive tumor is also useful.
Okay. Wow. Great explanation. Dr. Friday, question for you. So now we've discovered that all these genes, these mutated genes, are messing up our recipe and creating things we don't want and creating these tumors. So it seems like the next step is to fix these genes with gene therapy. Is that science fiction, or is that something that's being looked at and worked on?
Their gene therapy is not new. I mean, there's been gene therapy going back, to the 90s of things to do. There's a lot of research into looking how to repair these things. I think the problem, it becomes the same thing with delivering your treatment, is you only want to deliver your correctness to the tumor. You don't want to change anything else in the body. So just like giving your therapy or giving your radiation, you know, doing these corrections, getting it where you want it, is still an issue.
I see. So, Dr. Kavanaugh, it sounds like there's all these great advances in medical oncology, and Dr. Nursey, lots of great advances in radiation oncology. I mean, what are the surgeons doing? what's new in surgery? Unfair question. Okay, so where does...
Well, to be fair, they do have somewhat less invasive techniques, recovery can be faster.
Okay.
But, in the end, you're still... The goal is to remove something. So,
got it. So now, of course, y'all work with surgeons.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because you have to get these tumors and look at them. So the surgeons help get those tumors out. And we're, we need to talk about pancreatic cancer and lung cancer soon. But how do y'all know whether to give chemotherapy or radiation therapy, and when to use surgery, and when to use two or three or one? How is that figured out between you? How does a patient know whether, hey, I need to go see Dr. Dursey for radiation, or Dr. Kavanaugh for chemo, or Dr. Friday to go check my genes, or, is there a surgeon I should go see? How does a patient know?
I'll start, and Dr. Dursey, you can kind of jump in too. So there's lots of different ways to kind of get an answer. Generally, when a patient is diagnosed with cancer, it depends. Are you diagnosed based on a mammogram? And, then the person from the mammogram sends you to a medical oncologist or to a surgeon. Did you go into the hospital because you have stomach pain and you get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, so you see a surgeon immediately? So it sort of depends on how that cancer is discovered. But one of the things that I love about working in cancer is that it's a team approach. It's very rare that a patient will not need multiple disciplines. And when I say multiple disciplines, I'm a medical oncologist. So my role is to give chemotherapies, But I also look at my role is to be a little bit of the navigator between the other modalities too. So, you know, I try to make sure that patients get connected with radiation oncologists and surgical oncologists. There's, you know, there's even what we call interventional oncologists who help us. There's ENT oncologists. So there's a very wide variety required to work in cancer. And the way that is decided in general, there's national standards based on very, very large research studies that have been done. But then locally, every patient is different. So each patient is discussed either at what we call a tumor board, meaning all of those kind of disciplines that I mentioned get together and discuss what would be the best options for the patient. Or it may be too, just that I have a patient that I think needs radiation, but I'm not 100% sure. So I pick up the phone and I call Dr. Dorsey and we discuss it over the phone. So it's not, I think, just a one way fits all.
So there are guidelines for, I would imagine, the more common cancers, but you mentioned cancers that are rare and unusual. So in those situations, well, what if there aren't guidelines? What if, you know, this is something very few people see and they're, you know, over the course of many years? What do you do in a case like that?
So a couple different approaches. Again, this is when you really need that multidisciplinary getting together and talking as a team. The other thing, too, is I reach out to people I've met at meetings or centers of excellence in that field. Like we know at WashU, there's a center of excellence in sarcoma. So if I have a question, I would reach out to some of the people that work there. That's another thing, like places like MD Anderson, who there's a specialist there who sees a type of sarcoma that there may be one patient diagnosed in the United States every 2 or 3 years. So if you find someone who treats the most amount of patients you can, kind of discussing with them, or if the patient can or would like to, also maybe even going to that, see that person face to face.
Now, you mentioned that in cases where it's a rare tumor and it's not clear how to treat them, that sometimes you'll use this gene sequencing to help you decide what their best treatment is.
And so that's been a difference maker, especially for not only what we don't know what to treat patients with up front, but when the patients have had, you know, one or two different chemotherapies and they're maybe starting to not feel quite as good, or, you know, saying, look, I'm tired of this coming and getting chemotherapy and sitting in this infusion chair for 8 hours or however long it is, getting this, the CancerPlex testing will give me more information about not only medications that might work, medications that might not work, which is very important to know as well. And the way we've always kind of approached cancer is we do studies where we treat a certain type of cancer with a medication to see if it works. Now we're kind of doing the opposite. We are looking to see if a patient has certain mutations, and then we have a medicine that we know works in breast cancer, but it's the same mutation. So why not try it in colon cancer? When it's the same mutation, it may work there too.
So what percentage of patients do you think their treatment is modified or in some way influenced by the results of this testing?
So that depends on cancer type. And I'll say that because in like, I see mostly GI, so I use the GI cancers kind of for example. But in colon cancer, I need to know immediately some of these mutations or some of these markers to start treating up front. So it's going to affect some cancers immediately. I need to know this. Okay. Sometimes it's going to be used kind of more down the line for treatment. So I would say in a cancer like colon cancer, it's going to be a very high number of patients because it's going to affect my first line therapy. In patients like pancreatic cancer, where we're starting to think that, you know, there may be other things than just these mutations kind of driving pancreatic cancer, it's going to be a lower percentage of patients that we're going to get a mutation to to be able to attack. And the other thing is, in a lot of your solid tumors, like breast cancer, colon cancer, there could be hundreds or there could be thousands of mutations. So knowing what we would call a driver mutation is important. That means if you have 100 mutations, maybe only one is actually causing the cancer. And so if you're giving someone a medication against those other 99, it's not going to do anything. You have to know which one is kind of that driver. So that we're also working to find out that information as well.
Got it.
Okay. Once again, the phone number is 1-800-552-8502 for those who'd like to call in the next 20 minutes for a question for our guest. Dr. Dursey, I understand you treat quite a bit of pancreatic cancer and colorectal cancer. So since it is pancreatic cancer awareness month, how common is this and how would someone know if they have pancreatic cancer?
So pancreatic cancer is fairly common. It's as much as the fourth or fifth most common cancer in the country. Unfortunately, it has a tendency to present in advanced stages because it doesn't have a lot of symptoms early on. The pancreas is an organ situated in the middle of your body, kind of about the size and shape of a small fish. Many of the tumors start in the head that can lead to turning yellow, and that's one of the most obvious symptoms that people will have. But often, if the tumor's out by the tail, it doesn't block off the ductwork from the liver, and so you don't get yellow. And you can have a tumor that ends up very much bigger and has a chance to spread before you find out. Most people with pancreatic cancer will have some degree of abdominal pain, which all of us have reflux or dyspepsia. So there's nothing specific that way. If you get jaundice, that's the turning yellow part, that's a problem and should be investigated.
So what makes pancreatic cancer such a lethal cancer? Is it because people present so late that the cancer spread, or is it just inherently not responsive to treatments?
It's both. The majority of people present with relatively advanced disease. For those that pancreas is more or less pretty straightforward. If you said here's people with pancreatic cancer, about 1 out of 5 would be candidates for surgery, and most people would argue that if you're going to quote cure pancreatic cancer, surgery should be a significant component of your treatment. So basically 1 out of 5 people can be potentially cured, and of those 1 out of 5 end up being long-term survivors. So if you do the math, that ends up being roughly 4 or 5% of people are long-term survivors. Things have improved some, and honestly, that's more on the chemo end than the radiation end.
Yeah.
The radiation is applicable, somewhat less so than before, just because the chemotherapies have improved.
Yeah. So you're saying if people present with more advanced disease and the disease has spread, that sounds to me like the chemotherapy would be really important. Has that gotten better, those treatments, Dr. Kavanaugh?
Chemotherapy is getting better. You take, when I say getting better, you also then that comes with some side effects and things too. So, it's kind of a fine line that you have to walk to make sure that patients are having good quality of life. Because again, the whole goal at this point is to prolong their life, but in a way that they can do the things they want to do. And there's definitely still a role for radiation in pancreatic cancer. These cancers like this are, again, one of the ones that we very specifically look at each patient individually, and we still do the studies on large groups of patients, but it, because of the area of where the pancreas is and because it is a harder area to research and to treat, every patient has to be kind of looked at as an individual and decided as a group what the best thing for that patient would be.
So you're treating the patient, not the cancer.
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. So now let's talk a moment about lung cancer. What distinguishes lung cancer from pancreatic cancer? How are they different?
Well, so basically fairly straightforward. We name cancers for where they start. So a lung cancer started in the lung, a pancreatic cancer starts in the pancreas. interestingly, it matters a lot where the cancer starts. So we had mentioned earlier prostate cancer. Most of the time, that's fairly indolent or slow. Pancreatic cancer is hardly ever indolent or slow. Most lung cancers are not particularly slow, although there's the occasional one that is. When you identify a mass in something, then you have to get a piece of it, a biopsy, and look at it under the microscope in order to give it a name. Most pancreatic cancers tend to be a particular type called gland cancer or adenocarcinoma, and then there's the rarer neuroendocrine tumors. But in the lung, there's a good variety. There's the not small cells and then the small cells. And in the not small cells, there's gland cancers and squamous cells. These are just names, large cells, bronchoalveolar. A lot of those tend to act the same. So if you have a lung cancer, you can pretty much say, look, it's a small cell or it's a not small cell.
I see. And the treatments, I imagine, would be different depending upon what kind of lung cancer it is.
So the treatments vary by the type that you see under the microscope, and perhaps even more importantly, the treatments vary by how much you have. So that if you have a staging being generally 1 to 4, where 1 is early and 4 is late, if you have a 1, maybe that's something that you can treat by just doing some surgery. Or maybe if you're not a great surgical candidate, because a lot of people with lung cancer, they don't have the best heart and lungs. Some of those people can be treated well with just radiation to that area. As the disease gets more advanced, like it's beginning to spread into the lymph nodes, depending on how far that is, there may still be a role for surgery, but more often than not, then it falls into the realm of using chemotherapy and radiation therapy together to try to do the best you can for that.
I see. So, you know, we hear the term targeted therapy a lot. And I know Dr. Kavanaugh was talking about targeted therapy, but then we also hear about targeted radiation therapy, I guess with lung cancer specifically, as well as I guess in some other sites of the body. Can you say a little bit about that?
So, in terms of targeting, we're primarily targeting, again, geometrically. So let's use the lung as our example. If we had a small tumor, we could do something called radiosurgery, which was a concept that was initially started in treating some brain tumors, where they used very high doses to a small area to actually ablate or eradicate that piece of tissue. And so if you do radiation in a way where you're treating a small area to high doses, you can actually eradicate pretty much everything in that area. Radiosurgery works well as long as you can keep yourself confined to an area that the adjacent tissue is not damaged.
Okay. So what about when the cancer has spread? I understand sometimes they're using targeted radiation for cancer that's spread to other parts of the body, perhaps not in very large amounts. How often is that done?
So radiation for disease that's already spread is less commonly utilized, but there are, we had mentioned them earlier somewhat. So for example, spread to the liver is common enough. Colon cancer can do that. Pancreatic cancer can certainly do that. It's one of the reasons it's not such a great cancer. And so if the disease is widespread in the liver, that can be treated with chemo. Let's say you've done chemo and it has reached a plateau of response, then you can treat it with selective internal radiation, which uses a chemical called Y90, but that's just its name, Y90. It's put onto little plastic beads or glass beads, which is actually pretty interesting, however they do that. But those little beads have radiation on them. They can be put through an artery directly into the liver. They flow down the artery and they embed at the end of it in the small capillaries. They stay there and they deposit energy just where the tumors are. It works well in liver because Mindy had mentioned earlier that tumors do a lot of things to try to improve their odds of survival. And one of those things is they grow a bunch of new blood vessels. So whenever you're putting the beads in through the artery, they'll go much more often to the tumor than the normal because there's a lot more small blood vessels on the tumor.
Yeah.
The other main targeting, the medicines like lutetium that are using some sort of marker to track down. So in that case, they're looking at somatostatin, but that's, again, just a name, a receptor on these particular tumor types. There's another one called Zevalin that looks at targeting certain lymphomas. So again, it's got an antibody or some way to recognize a protein on a cell that is pretty much unique to the cancer and not on something else.
You're pretty smart, Dr. Dersey.
No, I'm not.
We have a caller. We have Leon from Bossier. Let's see if we can get Leon on the line here. Leon, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a comment about your lack of people calling in. I think it is because your show is so mesmerizing. You're doing such a wonderful job of spreading this information that I think everybody's just sitting here listening.
Leon, thank you so much. You know, it's funny. I told my guests that sometimes we don't get any callers at all for the very reason. And sometimes the topics are kind of complicated and people, you know, just want to grab every bit of knowledge. But I do appreciate you calling, and that's very reassuring. Sometimes if we don't get callers, we wonder if people are listening. So
you guys are doing a fantastic job.
I appreciate your call. Thank you. One thing that was very interesting I'd been reading is that now that some of the targeted radiation is being used in conjunction with some of the targeted chemotherapy, the immunotherapy, and that by treating some of the what we call metastasis or some of the lesions that had spread, you can actually, you know, stimulate the immune system so that some of the targeted medicines, the immunotherapy, actually work better. So it's really kind of exciting how they can have some synergy.
Right. So the immunotherapies are again looking at some protein on a cell surface that they can react to. And the concept is that if you treat some part of the disease with actually pretty high doses of radiation, by killing the cells and disrupting it, you sort of generate an immune response. And that makes the immune therapies work even better. So, for example, in prostate, that's one. By treating either one of the spots that's in the bone or treating the prostate, you can improve the efficiency of the immunotherapy.
Very good. Well, by the way, Dr. Friday and Dr. Kavanaugh, y'all very smart too, by the way. I didn't want to single Dr. Dersey out. But in the few minutes that we have left, Dr. Kavanaugh, can you touch a little bit on when to use the immunotherapies, those specific targeted therapy versus the chemotherapies or specific diseases or cancer types?
So right now it's more in the metastatic second, third line cancers. And there's specific things we look at to say whether we think it's going to be more likely to respond to an immunotherapy or not. As we become more knowledgeable about the immunotherapies, these have started to move their way into what we call first line treatment, meaning as soon as someone is diagnosed, we can use these therapies instead of having to use some of the more toxic therapies. And actually in some cancers like lung cancer and melanoma, it's actually used in patients that are for cure. We're finding that it's even helping stop that cancer from coming back again. So there's studies being done all over the United States, all over the world, to try to find the best ways to use these immunotherapies. And right now, I would say the biggest users is melanoma. Immunotherapies have absolutely changed the way we treat melanoma and made it from a disease that you have very, 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 very little time to live to, that we can keep melanoma under control and do better for a couple of years. Same thing with lung cancer. Just in the past, I would say year to year and a half, the way we treat lung cancer is completely different because of these immunotherapies. Some of the GYN cancers now are starting to come into that same realm, as well as the head and neck cancer. Recently, we've seen that using immunotherapy is having good results. So it's also there's one thing we look at. It's called MSI. It's, again, it's just kind of one of those names that we use. And it is the first marker that has ever, that a therapy's been approved for. Doesn't matter what type of cancer it is. If a patient has this certain marker, you can use immunotherapy no matter whether it's breast cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. And that's the very first time that's ever happened in cancer.
Wow, very exciting. We have just a few minutes left. I want to get to a caller is on hold. We have David. David, welcome to Health Matters.
Oh, welcome. I would like to speak to Dr. Kavanaugh.
Yep, she's here.
Yeah. So, Dr. Kavanaugh, I've been hearing about CRISPR, and I would just like to know whether there's been any progress in terms of how it's helped with cancer or anything about that.
Is that a question for Dr. Friday or Dr. Kavanaugh?
I'm sorry.
Anyone that could answer that, because I've been hearing much about it, and I've actually been reading about it, but I haven't known much about its progress in terms of helping out in treatment with cancer or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I think that right now it's probably still
it's in the research phase.
Yeah, I was going to say more of a research, used more in some of our very, very rare cancers as in very... early trials, but mostly they're still researching, trying to figure out the best way to kind of bring this trial into, or bring this therapy into clinical use.
Okay. Because the reason why I keep asking was because, as I keep reading about it, I felt like it is something that looks much more promising, but I actually haven't seen anything in terms of trials or anything like that, so I thought maybe I could bring it up and you guys could actually elaborate much more about it.
Well, and, again, like Dr. Friday mentioned a little bit, genome editing is something that has been looked at for a very long time. It's just, again, we have very good ideas about things that we want to do or we want to try. The problem is when we actually bring those into a therapy, it's hard to know how to get those to work. And also making sure that it's okay to use in humans takes a very, very long time. So hopefully we'll get there and be able to utilize the technology, but we're not there yet.
David, thank you so much for that that question. So in the last couple minutes, just wanted to make sure, since we were talking about lung cancer, smoking, good thing?
Yeah, that's just perfect.
Okay, anyone here smoking? Anyone think that smoking is not a cause of cancer or something that, perhaps the jury's still out on? Is there?
Smoking is a distinct cause of cancer, and it's interesting because people can get cancers that they wouldn't say are related. So most people would say lung cancer and throat cancer and all that, but most people don't appreciate that their kidney cancer and their bladder cancers are distinctly and definitely related. So it can help cause all kinds of cancers. It's not a good habit to start.
Okay, well, with that, we're going to close off the show. I want to remind everyone that Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. And phone assistance this evening has been provided by Sheila Lawrence, Faiza Khan, and a new bot. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. And I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I want to thank my guests this evening, Dr. Friday, Dr. Kavanaugh, and Dr. Dursey. Have a good evening.